Major Han, Royal 30. Like you were saying that you had sappers to help you with blocks, and that when they were prodding for mines, you generally kept out of the way.
Yes. Well, because, well, one knew the effect of mines, and, you know, it's common sense that one would say, right, you get on with your job, we'll keep out of the way, and when you say it's all right to go, we'll go. But so that's had been a folly to got too close.
Did you suffer any losses due to mining or booby trapping on that journey?
No.
So they were efficient in.
They were, yes. And as I said, we sent people down south because the going was slower on the coast road, and the colonel was anxious for everyone to push on. So the ones that went down south and came out, they were meeting up with lots of resistance. So I said that Dick Bromley was killed, and then we had we formed a special recce troop of two jeeps with an officer, a sergeant, and two troopers, you know, to try to go on. And it was commanded by Lieutenant Van Burton, and we lost them. They were all captured.
Was that south of the road then? Was that south of the road in that rock country?
Yes, to the south.
Yes.
In that particular, so they were obviously expecting stuff to come up around that way because it was probably an easier way to go on the slow push up the coast road. So we lost them, but eventually we got to the Tunisian border. So that meant the whole of Mussolini's empire had now fallen.
What did you do for overnight stops when you were making that slow progress up the coast road?
Well, all you could do was to stop where you were.
On the road?
On the road. Unless you could find that you could get off of a little. I mean, obviously there was the odd occasion where you could get off a bit where the ground looked suitable. But it's just a matter of ghost to the road and stayed on it, you know, with a car well ahead, you know, to give you any early warning. But it wasn't a very pleasant area. I'll say it was a no man's land, obviously, between Libya and
Tunisia.
So it was, as one would expect, a pretty desolate area.
Did you go through any settlements on the way?
No, nothing. There was two towns that was, I think they said it was Zabia, was it? Zabia and Zwara. They were the only two sort of small village sort of places that were anything like. But there was no sign of any life or anything there. As we went through, obviously the inhabitants kept well out of the way. But by then we were having a lot of problems with the armoured cars, with the going we'd been on, and the rough conditions. One of the main things, I think, as I told you, the starter motors were jamming with the dust and the sand getting in the sand in the starter motors, and the only cure for that was to if you couldn't start, you'd lift up the engine cover. As the driver pressed the starter motor, you would have a pick helve and you'd whack the top of the starter motor. Give it a jog, and that used to
shift the dust, presumably.
Shift it enough to make it start. That was a cure. It's like kicking a radio set or something if it didn't go. That's all. That seemed to have to work all right anyway. But the trouble with that, if you had happened to switch off and you were in a tricky situation,
it was very, very difficult to lift the lid and bash the starter motor with the pick hole.
Yes. It was quite heavy, the engine cover, because it was a flat sheet of armour sheeting, wasn't it, plate, and you'd have to lift that and catch up and hold, and then you'd have your thing to bang. But if you were in a dicey situation, that was, all took time. So I think the answer was, don't switch off unless you...
keep the engine running.
That's right. Mm. So our next objective from there was the border town of Benghadan, which it was well fortified with all the concrete blockhouses and defences built up amongst the sand dunes. It was quite interesting driving through. The Germans didn't use it to defend.
Mm.
It was, as we drove through it, you could drive through and you could see all these little pillboxes and things all around on the border of Libya and Tunisia. And it looked very interesting.
Do you think it would have been difficult to take if they had occupied the positions?
I think it would have been, really, because I don't know if they'd have had the blockhouses and that sort of thing. I think were mainly for infantry and machine gun. I don't think they would have stood up against a tank unless they could get anti-tank guns in the position to get a decent line of fire. So probably the Germans had obviously looked at it and said, well, this is no...
Could they put anti-tank guns in the blockhouses? Were they big enough to house an anti-tank weapon?
With the type of guns they had, they probably couldn't get them in to give them a good field of fire.
Mm.
And they knew jolly well that they could be cut off, probably, and they might have delayed someone, but it would have meant that whoever was in the defence would eventually be captured and would have been worthwhile. And I think all they would have done, really, they'd have just, all right, leave a couple of armoured cars there and cut it off and go on and just isolate it.
Mm.
I don't think they'd have achieved anything.
So it didn't go very far inland? Was it just covering the road down this complex?
It went down a bit, but how far, I'm not quite sure. It probably came from the coast down, because it was the main defence between two countries. So, but I should say it was more of an infantry, as opposed to a tank, because there was no high ground where they could get a good view, good field of fire.
Have you any notion of how old these defences were, what vintage they might be?
Oh, I think they go back a long way, because I think I read in a book once where they did an exercise, I think the British did, coming from, what's the oasis right down south?
Siwa.
Siwa. I think they came up with the French and did an exercise about how they could capture that some years before. I don't know what year, but I think you could probably find out. And I'm sure that's what they did as an exercise to see what could... well before the war started, this was. So I think they probably could have been from after 1914, 1918 they might have been built.
I was about to ask whether they were possibly a First World War vintage or...
Well, I suppose they could be, but I can't say really, but they didn't look modern buildings to me. So I think they could have been after, round about the First World War.
Perhaps the 1920s when there were conflicting claims to North Africa, the Italians and the French squabbling about it.
Just about that, because that was Italian property, Libya then, wasn't it? They'd, as their empire, so it could have been built round about that time.
The French had Tunis. They had a sort of special status in Tunis.
Yes.
Did you notice any change in the country or the style of buildings or anything as you went into Tunisia?
Yes, I think we did. There was a different sort of atmosphere. I think there was more buildings, more farming, more little what do you call it, small holdings, things like that. Not cattle-wise, but certainly from trees, fruit trees and things like that. And of course then you came up into places like Davies, Spats and that, which were big towns and ports. Anyway, once we got through to around Bengarden and saw this thing, and on the 12th of February, four troops lost two armed cars due to landmines.
Was this carrying on down the coast road, or were you?
No, this was out.
You were deployed.
Yeah, I think it might have been on a track or somewhere. But anyway, they might have got into a minefield, I think, perhaps, which was protected and probably sort of south of Gabies, perhaps, or you know, the approach to Gabies. But the two armed cars were destroyed. So we had to send, we sent a lorry to recover the guns, the radios, and all the equipment off it.
How did that happen? Because didn't they have their mine clearance team with them?
No, they're just individual troop. Each troop didn't have a mine clearance place. They were there for the squad to allocate, you see, and these troop was going on its normal patrol, and it was just probably bad luck that they went over the mines. I don't know whether they, I can't recall offhand if they were in a outside a village or what really. But I've got a picture of one of them, and they didn't look anywhere near a town. It looked just on a flat piece of ground, you know, which was just. So why they might have made a line of them, you know, unmarked as they used to.
Were you in contact with the enemy directly at that time, or were you?
I think they were, you know, in contact.
So were you doing the same sort of skirmishing as you had in the desert earlier on?
Yes, the same type of thing. You know, you'd see them, not necessarily shooting, but you'd know they were ahead and that sort of thing. So we had to go off to, or we sent off to get these the equipment off the vehicle. We knew we couldn't recover them, and I think leaving the guns on wouldn't have been a good thing. And so I went with the lorry to give it protection, you know, to bring it back. And it was then that this 109 fighter pilot who had been shot down between us and the German lines, which I suppose only about 5 or 6 miles apart, if that. His name was Willy Reuter. He's a short, stocky, dark man. And I had him on my vehicle, hoping to get rid of him that night, or before the night, because I didn't want him overnight, because he'd be a problem.
How did you pick him up? Did you just run across him, or was he thumbing a lift?
He got between us and the enemy, and there was five troop and myself, and we got him as he landed in his parachute.
Oh, you saw him descending?
That's
didn't you?
Right. So I finished up with him, and it was my job to get him back. So for some reason or other, I couldn't get back that night. So I'm afraid he had to stay with us. Now, we had the lorry crew, which was Corporal Pussy Catling and Lofty Barnes, Tyneside, was a lorry driver. And they gave him cigarettes and they shared the food with him and that sort of thing, you know. No hostility, although they'd bombed us and whatnot, machine gunners and whatnot. You know, once he was our prisoner, they looked after him as well.
Did he say anything to you?
Not really. You know, we asked him where he lived. He came from Bremen, and but nothing. He could understand English, and so we couldn't get back that night. So we had to stay out on the desert. I got on the radio and informed RHQ or H Squadron Headquarters and told them that we'd have to stay out the night. And it was a beautiful scene, golden sand, hillocks, full moon, you know, lovely night, it really was. And that's where we decided to stay the night. I unlaced my desert boots, kind of took off my gun belt and threw it inside on the floor of the armored car. I thought, well, that's me for the night, relax. And I was leaning against the front of the armored car, dreaming, I suppose, and Willie Reuter wanted to go to the loo, so I gave him a shovel and said, oh, just go out there. So off he went. I was still leaning back or thinking, you know. And I thought, well, I better watch him, because after all, he's a fighter pilot. So I sort of kept half an eye on him, and I could see his shadow in the moonlight. And suddenly, he threw the shovel away and off he went, straight for his own lines.
You know. Running away.
Running away. Mm. Oh, God. So I shouted, stop, halt, or I fire, you know. And straight away I was running. I didn't have time to grab my gun out of the car because I'd lost sight of him, you know. Although it was a beautiful moonlight night, there is a certain distance when so he knew I didn't have a gun anyway, so I was running and he was going away, and I went after him. I think I chased him for at least a mile, and I'd always been a very good cross country runner, so I was, you know, used to running in that sort of
soft ground.
Yes. I used to be the regimental champion anyway, and so running was the thing I could do. And I think I ran a mile in 4 minutes 20, when the world record for Sydney Woodison was 4 minutes 8. So I could run. And unfortunately for Willie Reuter anyway, so I ran and eventually came alongside of him, and as I got level I hit him at the back of the head with my forearm, knocked him to the ground, and then jumped on him and started flailing him, and we had a bit of a sort of set to and a wrestle and whatnot.
Could he box?
Well, not really. I mean, I could box, and so
sounds like a very unequal contest.
Well, he might have carried it. He was thicker. He might have been stronger than me, you know. At least I think I had the advantage. I think I could run and had the wind. He probably might have exhausted himself in the in the run to get away, so I think I had a slight advantage anyway.
What sort of start did he have on you when he set off, when he threw away the shovel?
Oh, between 50 and 100 yards, I think. I mean, you take, from a, in a full moon, moonlight, a man could be, what, 70, 75 yards, 100 yards away, and you'd still see his silhouette, wouldn't you? On a really bright moonlight with a golden sand, as I think. So he had a fair old start. And but anyway, I got my knees on both his arms and sort of was holding him and waiting for my armoured car to turn up. And of course, by the time they'd lifted up the engine cover and banged the starter motor, they came bouncing across the desert with the back still up. And of course, my gunner jumped out of the turret and he was furious. He was only a little chap, and a nice little man, a gentle sort of person, and a Scotsman. And he was hopping mad. He said, "I'll shoot him, let me shoot him." I said, "Don't be stupid, you can't shoot a man, defenseless man." He took advantage of it, he had all cigarettes, he had all things, you know, and then he runs away like this. I said, "Well, that's his duty to run away. You don't never shoot a man who's defenceless like that." But he was really hopping around. But anyway, I calmed him down.
He felt the ingratitude of the drum,
didn't he? He did. He was really, and yet he was a charming little man. He gently, I think he was a medical student before he came into the regiment. And but anyway, he calmed him down. And so we got back to where the lorry was. And I put up at a bivouac put up for him, one man bivouac or two man bivouac, and took away all his possessions, his clothing, gave him a blanket, said, "Right, get in there and don't move, don't put your head out of that tent tonight, otherwise I'll shoot you, and if you do, we'll have a sentry on all night, if you get out, I'll shoot you, or we'll shoot you, whoever's on." So he knew. And so the next morning, we gave him all his clothes back, all his a beautiful gold watch, rings, a wallet full of money, and gave it all back to him. And eventually got him back to RHQ, or Squadron Headquarters, rather. And when I got back, the squad leader apparently had reported that Willie Reuter was a prisoner, a 109 pilot, and to either division or brigade. And I came back down, like, "Watch him, they're important prisoners, don't let him escape, because they're short of fighter pilots." And I came back down the line to the colonel telling the squad leader. And the squad leader said, "Oh, not to worry, Freddie Hunt's got him." And didn't bother to tell me. Because when I told him what had happened, he actually doubled up with laughter and told me the story of having it come back to look after him. So I'm jolly glad I didn't let him escape. But it was all exciting. So from there on, and we had to move throughout that night, and we actually reached the town of Bengalan, which was separate from the border post, on the 15th of February.
What did you find when you got there?
What, the town itself?
Yes.
Nothing much, really. No sign of life. Didn't see any people. Probably, of course, we were probably on the outskirts. We didn't go actually through the town. But the whole area was deserted. And we carried on from there. Of course, the Africa Corps were withdrawing towards Medellin. And that was a small town, sort of, was it to the east, I think, of the Matmata Hills, which is the line of, it's a big sort of range, wasn't it, the Matmata Hills, which was a sort of a defensive from, separated the coast road from the other part of the desert, which was B squadron reached the town, but there was too much opposition there, we couldn't do anything about it.
Was this at
Medellin?
At Medellin,
yeah. There was very strong opposition, so we had to wait for the 7th Armoured Division to come up to take it on.
What? How did you discover this? Did you just run into anti-tank screens?
Yes. Or, yes. Mm. And I was given a task just outside Medellin that you could. There's a big hill. I can't think how high it was. It was quite a high feature anyway. And I had to get up on there to observe and report on the forces, you know, what they were doing. And I went round from the coast road, and I went round the back, the other side of the hill, the opposite side to the coast road, and there was a small track that went up. And there were signs of landmines as I went up the track. And so what I used to do if I saw a landmine, I never used to try to lift it, because we had learned that they were being booby trapped. You know, we lift one and the wire would attach to another and blow it up. And I wouldn't take any chances on that from then on, when I knew that sort of thing happened. So whenever I saw any mines, I would get a slab of gun cotton, put a primer in it and a bit of fuse wire, set the fuse going, and withdraw and let it blow up.
What did you look for? What were the signs of mines when you were travelling?
Well, as you're going along, you'd see where the soil had probably been disturbed on the track. You know, you wouldn't be going absolutely flat out. You'd go cautiously. The driver would be looking. You'd be looking. And if you saw any sign that a little bit of disturbance was it, I mean, it would be fresh. If it had been, say, 3 days old, you wouldn't notice it. But as it was sort of fairly fresh, then you would keep your eyes open for it. And I blew up a couple of mines on the way there. And I got to the foot of this feature. And I left my armour car at the bottom and said to my driver and gunner, "Right, you stay here, I'll go up." So I climbed to the top. Well, I say climb, it was a gentle sort of slope that you could walk up fairly well. And you couldn't get a vehicle up there, I mean, it was too steep for that. And so I got to the top. And I could get a good view and see lots of the enemy, and so I was sort of observing through my binoculars and sort of writing things down and imagining. So I stayed up there, I suppose, about half an hour or so, might have been longer, writing down. And I thought, right, now it's time to go back and get on the radio. And as I got up and started to walk to go back, all around me, I could see these little prongs of S-mines. You know, it was like little, bit bigger matchstalks in a set of three sticking out on the ground. And they were everywhere around. I thought, my God, how did I get here without treading on them?
And how did you get there without noticing them?
That's what I say, I didn't. I think probably I might sort of say, well, I might not have gone exactly the same way. You know, but I know I've been laying up there and looked, and I thought, oh, well, I'll go back down and start to walk. And that's when